this week, and I'm jumping in to the podcast as well. Dad and I today are going to be talking to my friend Richard Graham, who I met, oh my gosh, what would it have been, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, something like
Right,
that.
five, 6 years ago. Oh,
Yeah.
5 years ago.
My God, that's gone really quick. But when I first came to Japan, I started teaching and I needed to know how to do that quick. And someone recommended that I look up Richard's classes and Richard's program called Genki English. And he happened, I think it was like that month that I like found you, happened to be doing like a talk session in Tokyo. So I went along and that's how we met. And we're talking, all of us today, really in particular, in reference to the fact that Dad and I started these art courses at the beginning of last year, and Richard helped us set all of that up. And in the process of setting everything up, we had some really interesting conversations about creativity and teaching creativity in the future of education. So I really wanted to get Dad and Richard talking again. And yeah, that's basically why we're all here today. Have I said everything? Is that got it all in?
Well, you should tell that Richard really helped us found the art school.
Yeah. Yes.
Blimey, you make it. I'm glad you say that. It's very nice of you to say so. I didn't really do that very much, but thank you, and thank you for having me on the podcast as well. Because I've been through the other podcasts, and it's like a whole treasure trove of amazing people you've had on here. So to invite me, I'm sort of feeling a little bit intimidated, but let's see how we go with it. So it's cool.
Well, I mean, I do get asked two questions a lot, which is, where do you get your ideas from? And, well, I don't know how to draw. You're lucky. You must have been born with the talent. And I do have a view that pretty much in the same way, nearly everybody can be taught to drive. In the same way, with a similar motivation and effort, that would apply to drawing too. And the trick is when you drive, is the first time you drive, especially if it's a car where you have a gear shift, you have to remember, press the clutch, change the gear, take your foot gradually off the clutch, all those things you think about very carefully when you're doing it. And you're wondering how the hell you can at the same time not run into a tree. So it's incredibly intense analytical thinking. And the hope is that by the time you do your driving test, that's pretty much gone on to automatic. And that's really how I feel about drawing. You need to get this to the state of proficiency where you're not thinking about making a mark. You're just doing it. And actually, ideally, you're not even thinking. You're just letting the body take over. You're more like an observer.
The
So,
unconscious competence.
yes. So I sort of, that and the question about where do ideas come from, I have to admit, spend quite a bit of my career, certainly all my student life, pretty much taking it for granted that that's an unanswerable question. I mean, I've told this story quite a few times that I was sitting with a musician called Rameses, and he was asked that question by a journalist. And he said, oh, well, when I'm sitting quietly, they come from over here. And we all laughed. And I thought, that is what it feels like. And from then on in, it started to fascinate me. That process of letting go so that they can come in. And over the years, I have come very strongly to the conclusion this is eminently teachable.
Cool. I'd certainly agree with you in all the, we work with a lot of schools and a lot of teachers, and All the skills we do, it's exactly the same thing and the same process. The question I would like to flip to you is, so for me, my main creative output is music. So we do a lot of teaching using music for pre-literate kids and adults who are pre-literate as well, because music's a great way to do it. But I can't draw. So now, my growth mindset wise, that's a bad thing to say. So when you're talking about, you know, when you want to learn to drive, you go to driving school. So if I wanted to learn to draw and it's eminently teachable, where do I go to learn to draw?
Well, one of the problems with that is that art schools no longer are the, they're no longer the obvious answer. There is a lot of people doing classes, but art schools have gone away from the academic training that was the bedrock of all art schools up until the early 60s, when they abandoned it for a kind of limping philosophy and really destroyed the art education for generations of art students. So that is a problem that I think we're only gradually getting round to, but it's hard to teach competence when you're third or fourth generation of incompetent.
There we go. I love it. I love it when people say it how it is. We work with a lot of schools around the world. I always have to be a lot more politically correct when I'm talking about teaching and teachers and stuff. So when you say the academic thing, when you're saying the academic way of teaching went out, what do you mean by that? Because in my mind, that would tend to suggest, for example, people are learning from books but not actually doing. Whereas I would prefer, is that a different image in your mind?
That's not really what I meant. What I meant was the traditional method of teaching, which was an incredible focus on drawing and in particular life drawing. But drawing from plaster casts, all those drawing things, every which way. And I was incredibly lucky. I sort of got into art school the year that ended. And I got taken out of the fine art course and put into industrial design, where they were keeping all that. They still had life drawing. Mm-hmm. They still did all the different types of perspective. They did it all. And the fine art students suddenly were not trained anymore. And it's the training as opposed to the teaching that's critical. You need both. You need to acquire physical skill. The same would apply to music. You can be taught about music, but you have to do it to perform it. You have to acquire quite a high level of skill. And you know, you need both for art. You need a profound physical skill so that whatever ideas you have, whether they are small or vast, can be brought into the world by a competent machine, i.e. the artist. So it's, you know, without that physical skill, it tends to be drivel.
Yeah. So how do you get the physical skill? How do you learn it? How long does it take? Does it take years? You hear a lot about all these, you know, learn to draw in 30 minutes or, you know, get fluent in 2 weeks and things like that. Are those things real, or is it a thing that takes a long time, or are there shortcuts? How can someone who's not in this world, how can they get into it?
Well, I'll give you two answers to that. There's a kind of a cliche, but it's probably true, that to become a proficient concert pianist takes 10,000 hours. And that would apply to violin, to drawing, to playing guitar, whatever. So you need not only dedication, but a profound love of process to put that time in. But the army used to say to teach a driver from scratch to drive a truck, an army truck, if they were good, it would take 16 hours. If they were not good, it would take 18. So there's the two extremes. and I would say both apply, to be able to draw at a level that would surprise you 18 hours.
Wow.
To be able to be an international standard, 10,000.
But it's one of those... Sorry, I was going to ask you about this, Richard, because I don't know if you said this before, Dad, as well, but it's sort of like losing weight as well. The bigger you are at the beginning, the bigger the process is when you, the bigger the sort of progress is when you start. And if you're coming to drawing from having done nothing, I think those first like leaps are really exciting and you can go quite far with that. And then the further in you go, it's just polishing. But like with teaching what you teach, is that this, is that similar with other things? Is that similar with language? Are the biggest chunks, the biggest progress happens at the beginning or?
Yeah, I think, well, I think just by definition, if you're going by how much you're learning, yeah, so language is one of the main things that we do, and like growth mindset and things. You always, yeah, you learn more in the first lesson, and you'll probably never learn more than you will in the first lesson, because the first lesson you're learning, and then the second learning, second lesson, you're reviewing that and learning more, and then learning more and going. I think it's the same for all subjects, whether it's creative or not. If you're building the skill part of it, I always, that's different to creativity, which we might talk about in a minute, but. Yeah, I think that's cool. And I think the thing now is, so the thing we find with languages is that, you know, the traditional ways that are taught in school just take too long. So even if you do 1,000 hours, it might not get you where you want to be. Whereas there are a lot of shortcuts to get there faster. Like in languages, you do music and illustrations and all the sensors and everything like that. The interesting thing for me is when people... When people say, you know, anyone can do this, you can learn this skill, I think for a lot of people, they believe it's not true, which, you know, but then the next step is, well, how do I do it then? You know, who can I trust? And I think with education, it's this whole trust thing, isn't it? Who can I trust to help me, you know, get through that beginning stage? And can I go on YouTube and do it? Do I need a teacher? Can I do it myself? Can I do it from a book? Probably not through a book, because it doesn't move, but... yeah, and that's interesting how all the education is changing now. So, Roger, would you think that, you know, is it possible to learn it through YouTube and things, or do you need an actual teacher to give you feedback and things?
I'd say a teacher to you, yes. Getting a teacher to give you feedback is a really good idea, but if you're not putting in the hours, you know, and the more hours you're putting in, the less the teacher has to do. I mean, and it,
got it.
Nobody starts from scratch really with drawing, because it's an integral part of learning to see. So when you're a baby, you're making marks. So you give up on it at some point, or discouraged, okay, or whatever. But if you're not discouraged, it's just part of normal life. The thing is that a baby doesn't know what it sees. So it has two devices for understanding the world, hands and mouth. So they put things in their mouth and then they know what it looks like better, because they tested it. They picked it up and they put it in their mouth, and they now know more about that thing than just looking. Because the eyes are like a poor quality camera on a gigantic computer. And the brain needs to learn, and it learns from any tool at its disposal. So for a child, learning to see includes drawing, making
interesting
marks.
So I would never link drawing to seeing. I would, in my mind, it's something comes from your brain and then you would draw it down. I've never actually linked the skill of seeing and drawing. Is this a bit like the singing paradox? So, you know, so it's when babies are born, they, you know, they try and talk and things, and they go goo 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 goo. Well, they're walking first. So when they're trying to walk, they try to walk and they fall over, and then they walk and the parents go, "Oh, that's so awesome! You're so amazing!" And then when they fall over, they go, "Try again!" And the parents are encouraging them all the way. So they think, "Oh, that's cool, I can do it." And then when they begin to talk, they talk nonsense, and then the parents correct them with some language, and that's how they improve. And they keep going, and no parent ever says, "Oh, you're just not a walker. Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're not a talker, are you? You might as well give up, you know?" So they do that for those two. But the challenge is then what happens is then the kids, the next step is to start singing. And then when the kids are singing, the parents don't go, wow, that's cool, sing some more. The parents go, oh, will you just be quiet, please? And just tell them to shut up. So they have the, that's something, you're not a singer. Don't bother. And then they don't do the practice. So I don't know whether drawing fits in somewhere with that or not. Or maybe it's
because I think there are some things that are considered necessary, where if you don't encourage someone, it's a fundamental jolt to their sense of identity. If you tell someone they're not good at moving or talking, that's going to be a huge problem. But I think people consider certain things okay to criticize people for, because it's not that relevant necessarily to life. It's not that important. It's not integral to everyone's life to be good at art. So it's okay to tell some people that they're not great at it, or maths or whatever. And then you internalize that and say, oh, I can't do this thing or that thing. And like from teaching, in my experience, is that I think absolutely, as you say, kids particularly will do whatever they're encouraged to do, whether they're good or not. And you can't say a child is good or bad at art, but they certainly only get better if you tell them they're good.
Well, can I make a comment on that? A child isn't drawing in the sense that we think of it. They're not replicating. They're making a symbol and an intervention to improve the symbol works. So if you see a child do a squiggle and say, that's mum, you can't say, oh, that's rubbish, it doesn't look like mum. That is absolutely destructive. But you can say, that's fabulous. Does your mum really have green hair? You know, oh, wait a minute. There you are. That's perfect. You know what I mean? It's you're refining a symbol, not an effort to reproduce reality.
I want to ask both of you something, actually, because I think it's something that you've both said in conversations before, and Richard, you just said it now. So one of the things you were saying, Richard, is that doing music, or in my experience, art really helps with language. And I'm watching a lot of your Genki English programs. I remember seeing like games as well. They distract you from the learning, so you get less self-conscious and just do it more naturally. And Dad often says, like, when you're painting or drawing, listen to something. And so from those two things I've heard you both say, it seems like distraction is quite an important part of learning as well. Not having that whole part of your brain focused necessarily, but if you're drawing, having the verbal part distracted, or if you're learning the verbal part, having the visual and audio distraction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think definitely for languages, we do that with languages. That's why we use, so with the languages, you have the input and the output. You have to have lots and lots of input. I guess that must be like seeing in drawing, but so you listen to lots and then you practice output. And it can get really boring if you know, especially where everyone learned at school, when it's like, this is a pen, that is a book or whatever. Whereas if you can play a game where you've got to, you know, we have like Harry Potter games and like running games and games with random chance, so that it doesn't matter your English ability as such, the same people don't always win. So you can play a game, yeah, it distracts you and you just end up speaking. Or like when we use songs, you know, we have people speaking the target language. In 1 minute, they say it like 64 times, which really helps. So, yeah, and Roger, you were saying last time, you know, about the music thing. So how does that work? When you're practicing the drawing, you put music on?
I find music good for changing the energy level, lifting me up or calming me down. Excuse me. But I think, you know, take my mind out of the equation, the thinking, analytical part of my brain, which is absolutely a destructive factor. If I'm trying hard or something, it doesn't work. I find listening to an audiobook the better, because it's more of a distraction.
Wow, so, that's a lot of a distraction, isn't it?
Yes, I couldn't write listening to a book, but I can draw. In fact, I would say if I've got a lot of drawing to do, I can't do it without. You know, I always make sure I have a suitable number of audiobooks before I start a big project. So it's that thinking part of the brain vis-a-vis the intuitive part of the brain. And they are different. They're even, you know, the activity happen in a different part of the brain. I'm repeating something, but Niels Bohr said that he invented, you can look it up, he invented, or he had an idea called the gunslinger reaction. And his view was that two identically skilled gunslingers, the one who draws first will always lose, because he's thinking and using the analytical part of his brain, and the other person is reacting and using the reacting or intuitive part of the brain, and is therefore that marginal bit quicker. And Birmingham University have tested this and found it to be true. So it's, that's interesting. But it is, you know, if you're daydreaming, you are using that intuitive part of the brain and not the analytical part. And this is, again, something I've said, but if you're doing something hard work like quadratic equations, your brain is working 30% harder when you're just daydreaming. And how can you tell? How can you tell? That would be the question. You can tell by measuring work, which is measuring the temperature. The brain is hotter when you're daydreaming than when you're really working hard on the quadratic equations. By the way, I was taught, I had a really fragmented education. I went to 16 schools and I ended up in Ashford Grammar School with no real teaching in mathematics or physics. I love physics, but the physics teacher wouldn't let me join the class because I hadn't done any. But the headmaster allowed two of us to do it in our spare time, which meant he allowed us to take the exam. And we both passed, by the way, with reasonable results. Nothing sensational, but as good as the guys who did the classes. So that was interesting to me. But the maths teacher was brilliant because he didn't really get maths. And he would be there struggling on the board, and you could follow the struggle. You could, this is what he should be doing. And the whole class was engaged. I mean, maybe he was just clever, very clever at it. But it was really engaging watching him try and figure out how to do things.
Do you ever do that, Rich? Do you ever make intentional mistakes, hoping the children will correct you?
Oh, I've got so many real mistakes. I don't need intentional ones. Honestly, I spend all my time like with language teachers. You know, 99% of English teachers in the world don't speak English because they, you know, that they don't speak it. If they did, they'd probably get a better paying job. So I wonder if that actually works then with them. With them struggling through it and the kids getting attention. Actually, I'm trying to think back to this gunslinger thing. I'm trying to think, how did the university test this? I'm really like, they just, I presume they had light guns or something like that, but.
I've got
a question.
They had two people with buttons.
Ah, okay.
And.
Just press the buttons.
One of them had to press the button and the other one had to react. So one of them knew that they had to go first, but they had to wait and then go, shh. And the one who was reacting very often did it quicker.
So my next question would be,
they don't have a pile of bodies in Birmingham.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So my next question for that would be,
as far as I know.
If anybody can learn all these skills and say languages, music, art, I presume there's lots of other skills that we don't, even basic maths, things like this. And there's all these skills people can learn and they're not learning now through school because we know, you know, majority of people don't do it. Is the act of making it compulsory, does that kill it? Or is it purely a practical thing of we're just not teaching it as a society in the right way?
I would say the latter. And the compulsion, I would think, even when it's compulsory, you can make it work in a way that is not oppressive.
But there is that thing, isn't there? The difference between, I can't remember if this is the right phrase, but internal and external motivations. And internal motivations make you really want to do something. And external ones, like exam results, getting into university, getting a good job, getting paid better, actually don't just not work, but they make you not want to do something you already enjoy. I remember reading something about that, which made my whole education make sense to me. Because there were loads of things I love now and find incredibly interesting. But when I had the pressure of trying to get an exam result in it, didn't work for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're talking with music and, excuse me, art, things which have a physical element. Writing, although some writers write have beautiful handwriting, writing doesn't really have a physical element. So there isn't that separation of the physical with the mental, but there is a separation. I mean, I've heard lots of writers say they cannot write and edit at the same time. They have to have a day for writing where they can write anything. No editing allowed. And then they have a day for editing and correcting and improving. But the two must never be allowed to overlap. So, you know, there's no physical skill, but there is those two mindsets.
But in your experience, Richard, what have you found with the kids who are learning? Does it sort of help them to have, you know, the structure of education, or do they tend to learn better when there's less expectations on them?
I think it's, when you're talking about most of the things kids learn at school, I think, well, it's the things we deal with, like languages and maths and things like that. It's actually so easy. You know, in the household here, we speak five languages on a daily basis. So languages are actually incredibly easy if they're taught in the right way. The problem is that the school systems tend to kill it by doing all the grammar and all the book work. And you know, they start books before we speak. You know, humans have only been speaking, you know, we've been speaking for 200,000 years and, like, you know, writing for 5,000 or something. So so that they sort of kill it. But kids can do it naturally for the subjects I do. The ones, you know, like maths and science and stuff like that. So, yeah. So, I don't think that's really a problem. But it's interesting. Yeah, and it's interesting with the music one, because I just when you're talking about that, you're just thinking about. So when we play music now, is when we're writing music and producing music, is if you've got a computer, you don't actually need the physical act of playing the instrument. You can actually just write it straight into the software. Which is, you know, look at artists like Deadmau5 and things, they can't play, they just write it almost like writing by hand, and then the computer plays it back. So they don't actually need the skill of playing an instrument, which is quite an interesting sort of thing about it. So I guess the thing is, then you've got two things. You've got the skill of learning something, like learning to draw, learning to write, which is maybe quicker, and then learning an instrument or something. And then you got the next thing, which is the creativity, which I guess is what everybody, it seems everybody on the planet wants creativity. All jobs are going to be replaced by AI, but the creative ones might survive, although I'm not sure about that. But for me, the creativity always comes from two different things. So you take something here and you mix it with something else. Like yesterday, we were doing storytelling, and it's like, you know, you do storytelling skills here, but it has to feature lemons. And just putting that strange juxtaposition in there is what comes up with something creative. In your guys' experience, is that a good way of doing creativity? Does that lead to results, or are there better ways of being more creative?
I think it's a good way of starting, yes. I think there's an author called Alfred Bester. Excuse me. And he wrote a book that in English was called Tiger, Tiger. And I hope. And he told me a story about, in the Second World War, an American warship saw a raft with a lot of sailors on it. And they didn't go and pick them up because they thought, excuse me, it was a trap of some kind. And he thought how devastating it would have been for the sailors. And he combined that with another event to make the story. And I think combining two different things to make a third new thing is part of the process. It is what we do. And I read a book which Freya made me read because I'm very dyslexic. And it said The Dyslexic Advantage. And it did say that it's one of the things that people who are dyslexic can do very well. They can connect distant things. But yes, I think it's a good way. But I think, you know, there's probably half a dozen fundamental ways. I would say the most important way is to get you into that mindset where you're not analyzing, where you've put that part of the brain effectively aside, and you can do meditation, you can listen to a story, you can do all kinds of things to do that. But for me, that's a very important thing to do. A little bit down the line, yes, bringing in different ideas, seeing things differently. I can do a sketch without meaning to, and my sketchbooks start at both ends. And I can be looking through and I can see something upside down and think, what was that meant to be? Wow, I like this. And then realize later that it was meant to be the other way up. And in a way, is mundane because I'd been there, but with it upside down. So yes, looking at things differently. Getting in the basic information, gathering imagery, you know, is incredibly important. You can't produce ideas if you haven't fed them, if you haven't fed the brain. So you need to do everything. So I would say there's probably, like the seven pillars of wisdom, there's probably a few core ideas that you can teach that aren't amazing. You have to learn how to use them. But when you've got those, yes, they're all parts of the process of accessing your creativity, which I think, again, like learning to drive, there must be very, very tiny number of people who don't really have it.
Wow. You need to do a course on that. So, actually, I remember the first time I went to Freya's studio, and Freya, you were doing, I think, was it masks you were doing or something you were doing? And I was looking at the color palette on them, and I was just like, how on earth did you possibly think of those colors to go together? Because they were just like the most amazing colors, but they were not at all what you think. And Freya just casually just said, oh, it's this. And it was a book of tropical fish that you'd got. And you just taken the color palette straight from the tropical fish.
Yes.
Well, you know, why create when nature's already done it better?
Yeah.
Well, it's like Star Wars, isn't it? It's like when you look at the aliens in Star Wars, and it's like, obviously George Lucas just spent the day looking at National Geographic and thought, I'll have that as an alien, I'll have that as an alien, and just took them all in. But it's new for us because, you know, I'd never seen, was it kabuki mask or Japanese mask? I can't remember what you were making, but I'd never seen them with those colors.
Oh yeah, so that was what it was we had, so it was the Edo Festival in Tokyo, and where I work was having an Edo Festival kind of joint project. So we had people, everyone came in kimonos and I was doing stuff with the kids. So I thought it would be really fun, considering they're all wearing, actually yukata actually, if I did something Japanese for their faces. So I was looking at the kabuki masks, and they reminded me already of tropical fish patterns, because you have this sort of symmetrical kind of, you know, two-tone pattern going on, as if you'd sort of cut a fish open and splayed it. So I thought I'd work on that with the white base and then put the patterns over the top. But that's exactly that thing. That's exactly that sort of seeing how you can overlay one thing. So what the overlap is something that really works where they cross over. And ideally, the more things you bring in, I think, yeah, the more exciting it gets. Yeah, I think it's, I've heard someone describe it as composting. You put all these different things on a heap and then it generates all of this heat that breaks it down, and then you have this fertile product at the end. But I prefer thinking of alchemy because it's less disgusting.
I guess the next question that comes, so if we know how, you know, if you can build a skill and you spend your 1,000, 10,000 hours learning whichever output skill you have, and then you, there are ways for getting creativity, and I'm sure you guys have got millions of others as well, but just by, you're saying, thinking of one idea and combining it with another. I guess the next question is it okay to spend all day being creative? Like, how do you earn a living if you're just like, how, just, can you just be creative all the time? Or is it just you get a couple of ideas and then the rest of the time is bringing them to fruition? Or is it, you know, spending time looking for the people who are needing ideas? How does that all work in the modern world?
I think it is, the creative part is continuous. If I'm doing a painting, and I often put splash paint all over the canvas, so when I'm painting, it's constantly feeding back ideas. But in reality, I'd say the need to be creative possibly could be over before you even start the painting. You know, coming up with the idea for the painting and then just manifesting it. But, you know, the manifesting, your mind's off it, you're doing it, you are constantly doing little tweaks. So it's endlessly there. It isn't, it's never not there. Before we started, we were talking about the school teacher that Mark Stevenson wrote about in his second book. We Do Things Differently. And he invited himself to take on a school that was seriously failing. And one of the things he did turn around the school, but one of the things he did is that he observed that sometimes children help each other. And he kind of magnified that into a process where that kind of peer-to-peer teaching became part of the, I suppose you'd say, the philosophy of the school, and it really worked. So that was, for me, reading that, that was creativity at work at both levels. And yeah, I think, yes, as it's part of us, it has to be part of us, really. I mean, ooh, sorry about that. I will ignore that. That's Zoom saying
you. It's worse if you ignore it, Dad.
Sorry?
It's worse if you ignore it, because then we all...
Hi.
Take the focus. That's where the editing skills come in. You learn how to edit the podcast. And
our editing policy is to leave everything in.
Yes. Can I call you back? Okay.
I hope nobody rings me now. So, yeah.
Grandma. So I will have to call her back. But we've got.
Okay. Yeah. So, so Richard, for you, is that something that's part of how you've seen kids learning, is them teaching each other as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that our job is to make school genki, which is a Japanese word. It's like fun, energetic, full of life. You know, a kid's natural state is to be curious, is to learn stuff. Yeah, they need discipline to practice the skills and things, but they need lots of experiences, and peer learning works really well. I mean, when we're talking, the UK is actually really good for school. You know, my niece goes to the UK, and Australia and Canada have really taken on all this progressive ways of learning. It's really good. But a lot of countries are not. It's still, you know, Japanese schools or any schools, most schools in the world, the first thing you learn is, you know, you don't go in there and say, okay, kids, let's come and create something. Here's a great new skill. What do you want to learn to do? What would you love to do? If I could wave a magic wand and let you guys have any skill in the world that I could teach you, what would that be? They don't do that. You know, the first thing in a lot of schools is just sit down, shut up. And it's like that for 12 years. And it's like, so that's what we're trying to fight. So very often the kids learn better from themselves. And then you've just got to make sure they don't end up going down rabbit holes, you know, because, you know, you've seen like when you have twins and they make their own language and things like that, and they just completely go off something original, which is cool, but it's not good if it's a skill in developing their own mathematics system.
Not so, just you know. Twins that do that.
Yeah, so but in general, yeah, I think peer learning, the whole school system, well, my life for the past 20 years has been trying to change the school system. Like, I looked at kids being bored in school and just sat down and bored. I looked at teachers who are stressed out that they had to teach all this different stuff and using outdated technologies. I mean, you know, trying to learn a language from a flat textbook, even a language like maths, your maths is a language. My I've got a science background, you know, and you know, trying to teach science from a book that doesn't move, you know, you need to be able to, you know, when we're at uni, we're always thinking, you know, if you could have a PlayStation game where you could just twiddle the angles and move the black hole this way, you know, in uni, I was studying black holes and we're using NASA satellites to determine how fast they spin. Because when the stuff tries to get in, it shoots out a ray of, from the accretion disk. And then it, when it flips around, you see it as a flash of light and you can measure how fast. Anyway, so, but if you were doing that on a piece of paper, you wouldn't get it. But if you had a PlayStation model where you could twiddle it and look at it and things. And we were trying to do stuff like that with schools. And we've had a lot of success in a lot of places. But like in Thailand, they put our like English and self-development program, they put it on 800,000 tablets for kids in school in first grade, which was amazing. But then the government changed and they canceled the whole program. And one thing we've learned over the years is that it's politics. I think with the pandemic we've seen as well, it's, you know, the government's priority for schools is not necessarily for kids to learn. It's to get kids away from the parents so the parents can work. So it's an economic imperative. And I'm thinking school-wise and education-wise now, it's I'm tending to go for the American idea, which like people like Schwarzenegger and like Seth Godin, and they say, you know, they say, look, school is school. We're not going to change it because it's all politics. And we can help the teachers as much as possible, but we're not going to change the system. But the key for kids is what happens between 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock, because that's when the parents have control. And if the kids, you know, if the kids from 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock, when they finish school, if they're hanging out on street corners, they're probably going to get into all sorts of things. But if that time they're, you know, learning art or making movies or learning to DJ or dancing or doing something creative, or setting up a business, even teaching other kids, whatever it is, then I think that's the time. I think that's the time. That's where we can revolutionize things. And I think that's where YouTube and online courses and everything like that can really help. So, like yesterday, we were looking at some of the teachers were recommending these, you know, learn Russian while you sleep programs, and they're all slagging it off saying it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But it can work in certain ways. But there's the channel for Learn Russian While You Sleep. They've got 4 million subscribers on YouTube. It's just like crazy. And kids are learning, you know, they're learning music, they're learning music production, they're learning languages, they're learning all these skills on their own on YouTube. And I guess I think that's amazing that the kids can do that. But how do we get more kids into this? You know, if kids have been taught you're not a drawer, you can't draw, it's not possible, only the really talented are there. So how do we break that fixed mindset so that more kids can get into it? You know, can we go online and Roger, can you do a course for the beginners so they can do it and then move forward to your advanced courses as well?
I don't think
you need to. One called like, has someone told you you're crap at drawing? This is the course for you. I think that's so many people though, isn't it? That's so many people. And then you've just killed that thing for them.
Yeah, I would say just leave plenty of paper and pencils around and read to them.
But how does that compete with the dopamine hit of TikTok? So if I'm a 13-year-old kid, yeah, and you know I'm on lockdown. We're on lockdown here. It's crazy, and I've got the choice between a piece of paper, which I think might be sort of cool, but it's a piece of paper with a lot of hard work ahead of me, compared with my phone that has dopamine on tap. You know, I can go to TikTok and and I can go to apps and stuff. How do we bridge that gap? How do we make it so appealing? Do we just take away all the phones and the technology and then, you know, just...
But this was something that you were telling us about. Like, I remember when we were setting up the online course, we weren't sure how to do it. And, you know, the format and how you bring people together. But what we found, which you probably anticipated, was that when you have a group of people in a Facebook group who get over that initial thing of feeling shy about showing their work, they suddenly get incredibly encouraging of each other. And they're not just teaching each other, but they're like kind to each other and holding each other's hand and saying that's fantastic and supportive. And Dad, you always used to say that one of your biggest teachers of art was wanting to impress your mates. and I think that, so maybe they can be incorporated, you know, maybe there's a way of learning, because all of those people, you know, they may have told their families and friends what they were doing, but they could equally have kept it completely secret. So they had that private space to learn, as well as that online group of support, and that maybe a dopamine hit of someone saying, you know, that's fantastic, you're so much better than when I first saw you've improved so much. That's a nicer way of putting it, isn't it?
The other thing is, I don't think kids would expect to take their phone swimming or playing basketball. You know, there's lots of environments where, yeah, we'll put that aside for an hour, you know. And it's, even if they've got it with them and they don't, but they are doing something else. I think the younger you start, by the way, the easier it is, because you're nearer to the point when they were doing it and haven't stopped doing it.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. I mean, I keep going back, because I'm just thinking about me learning to draw, and I'm seeing as a non-drawer learning to draw. Do you set us, is it an hour a day, 10 minutes a day? How long does it take?
If I was teaching you to draw, I'd go back to the army and army example. Their view was, it's going to take you 16 hours to learn to drive. It doesn't matter if you do an hour a month for a year and a half or whatever, or you do it all in one go.
Ah, so does learning in one day, does that work? Like, if say if you did 16 hours in one day, if you could cope with that, would that be cool?
Yes, it would work.
Blimey. Okay, so Roger Dean's course on how to learn to draw in one day if you've been told that you're useless at drawing.
Well, yes. Apart from going and dealing with the person who told you that.
Well, yeah. No, but phrase, no, it's a great hook, because if we can, I guess, because your courses now are mainly for people who know your work and they want to learn, because they're going, how does he do that? And they, I would imagine most of the people in your courses now are quite advanced, yeah?
Total mix.
Oh, okay.
I would say even, oh God, he's going to edit this, so I've got to be. So my uncle, this is not an offensive thing I'm about to say, he would never have said that he was an artist. He would never have said that himself, right, bud? I'm sorry, I'm going to say this. But he joined in. So he was doing the administration, but he also joined in for the course. And like, his paintings are extraordinary now. And the difference between when he started from finishing the second course was absolutely amazing. So I would say, yeah, with all of the students, you know, maybe that was the most dramatic difference that I saw, but I would say they're not, I wouldn't think of any of them as beginners now.
Right. Not now, but at the beginning they were beginners, were they?
My uncle, no, I won't say that.
that's amazing. I mean, I've got a friend of mine, and she teaches art in the US. And she has a similar thing that, you know, anybody can learn to do it. But her problem is that she shows these before and after photos on Google, and it's like, you know, it's a stick man sort of thing. And then the next one, she got banned from Google because people were saying it wasn't real, it was a photograph. She was pencil sketching, and people were saying it was a photograph and not an actual sketch of the after photo. It was like, wow. So. Yes, we need to see you guys need to get on. Obviously, I shouldn't tell you what. Obviously, the listeners of the podcast, if it's something they're interested, I don't know. But getting on your students and just showing your students what they've learned and how they learned it, I think might be maybe interesting. I don't know, people watching this, if that's something you're interested in, I presume put it in the comments or wherever, but you know, getting your students on and then showing how they've improved might be cool.
Yeah, so actually that's something, so we're going to be launching the website, the Dean School of Art website, on the 4th of April. And a gallery was going to be part of it, a gallery of the students' work. But I hadn't thought of the idea of showing the sort of first stage compared with the last stage. And we should talk to them about that, Dad, shouldn't we?
Yeah, see if they want to, yeah.
Well, I guess the thing, you know, one of the thing when we're talking with... you know, when we deal with government schools, obviously it's, you know, what the government wants to teach, we have to teach. And then when we talk about, you know, private schools, people set up their own schools and either online now, well, been online for years, but everybody's online now, or a physical real school. It's, you know, we always say to people, you know, what's your goal? Who do you want to teach? You're not going to teach everybody. You're not going to reach everybody in the world, because, you know, even the big religious leaders didn't teach everybody. But, you know, who I always ask a teacher, you know, who do you want to reach? Do you want to just teach the kids in your neighborhood? Do you want to teach every adult in the world? Do you want to teach, you know, 100,000 people? So for you guys, what's your motivation with the art school? Who what change are you wanting to make in the world? Is it a legacy thing so your great grandkids can check it out, or is there a number of people you want to help, or what's your dream for it?
I think everybody benefits from learning to draw and paint. Everyone will benefit from learning to play a musical instrument. I think of it from just one point of view. The amount of real estate in your brain that's given over to hand-eye coordination is enormous. You are training the brain in a way that almost no other activity can do. So learning to play violin, learning to draw, learning to paint is a massive, massive brain enhancing process. So everyone benefits from it. And
so who do you want to teach? How many, do you want everybody to learn? Do you want every school to be taught? Like, what's your goal? What's your dream goal for the school?
I think every school should teach art and music. It should be part of any curriculum. But that doesn't mean to say it works, because I know kids who hated art and hated music. I mean, not because they hate music, but because they hadn't been engaged. And that's the trick, of course.
Or there's that comparative thing, isn't there? There's the kid in the class who's the music one, and then there's the kid in the class who's the art one. So everyone else feels they'll never match up. And I think talking about the art class, the next one, I quite like the idea of aiming classes at people who have this real need to express themselves but didn't learn the language. Because I was listening to some of Dad's previous podcasts, like, I don't know which ones you heard, Richard, but like the last one was Chris Braid, who's a songwriter.
Amazing. I don't listen to that many podcasts. I listen to a few, like the Motley Fool Money one from Investing is great, and a few other ones and stuff, and some of the music ones are great. But just going through your podcast and the people, that's why I was quite intimidated when you invited me on. I was like, blimey. But I was taking so many notes. It's like just great, and everyone's so humble with it as well. And it's like, wow. But there's so many different. There's such a trend. I think you've chosen a good name for this. But anyway, sorry, I've digressed.
No, I think that's the benefit. Like, that's what you see when you see people doing what they really love, is there's no need to sort of put a front on anything. But watching his and watching Neil Gaiman talk about writing, reading anyone talking about writing, every time I think there's so much in my mind I want to put out in that format, but no one taught me the way to do it. So whether it's songwriting or singing or writing a book, I would love to do all of those things, because they're different ways of expressing a different part. And I feel like I wouldn't know what it's like to not be able to draw and paint, but I can only imagine it's that same sort of suffocating feeling of having this part of you you want to put out, but you just haven't got the, like, if your vocabulary is very limited for whatever reason, and there's that word you're looking for and you can't say it, I think that's the same feeling. So I like the idea of teaching people who, for whatever reason, were discouraged or learnt but didn't learn how to do specific things that they really want to be able to do, like the technical stuff, or if they learnt that but they want to learn how to kind of express their feelings and be more creative. I like the idea of, yeah, giving people who are discouraged a way of having an outlet for all of that. I like the idea of that.
A lot of parents tell their children you can be whatever you want. But there has to be a certain unlocking in the brain to get rid of all the inhibitions about ability and about irrelevant focus and all kinds of things. And I think it would be good to have people feel that you can do whatever you want. You have to learn how to do it, but that isn't insurmountable. That's just part of the process. But if you want to do it, you can do it. And I think
that sounds great.
Well, you know, one of the things I find really frustrating in art schools is that people with a lot of ability go to art schools expecting to have their ability transformed into something wonderful, and it's pretty much ignored. You'd be astonished how many art students are never taught to draw or paint or do any of the basic physical skill stuff. And they end up, maybe their head's full of ideas, but they don't have the basic tools to get those ideas out into the world. And that's what you need to have.
That sounds, I mean, I'm wondering, like, Richard, in terms of like language, that's I think a similar balance, I'm guessing, in language is like you want kids like using it and playing with it, but then how do you also feed in the commas and the, you know, grammar and the verbs and adjectives bit? Or do you not, you just let that fit fall in?
Oh, yeah, I mean, the thing with, if you're talking about language is such an easy one. It doesn't actually take that long to do. So the thing with grammar and things is just, if you hear a sentence 100 times, or yeah, some people it's 7 times, some people it takes 50 or 100. If you hear it 100 times, you're always going to know that grammar and know it's correct. It's like, you know, if you hear I'd like an apple, is that an apple? Do you, what can we do with that apple? And like, you know, what color is an apple? And you hear an apple so many times, you know, it's an apple. You would never ever say apple because it just sounds strange. But the problem is that most schools, they do the dead frog thing. So, you know, if you want to see how a frog jumps, you know, if you want to learn how to language, or I guess drawing or things like that, is if you want to learn a new skill, is you look at the frog and you see how it does it. So if you want to learn how a frog jumps, you watch a frog jump and you go, okay. And then you copy it and you fall over and you think, he's not doing it like that. So you change it. And then you think, okay. And then you learn how it jumps. But if you cut it open and start describing it and saying this grammar rule for here and the rule of this leg is here, that's, you just end up with a dead frog. You don't end up with a live language.
Actually, my mum said this to me. She said, I don't know if you know much about Waldorf Steiner schools. I mean, that's a whole other podcast, but the one that I went to, they started reading at 7. Everything was put back later. And the idea was that, you know, you learn to communicate first and then the rest of it kind of falls in. But my mum was like, there's no way I'm not teaching my child how to read before 7. So at 4, we were sitting down and going through the books. And then my mum took me into school and she saw these other kids, how, like, she spent hours with me, you know, sort of sitting down, struggling. I was tired, I was bored, I didn't want to do it. And eventually I learned how to read. But then she saw these kids who just hadn't ever picked up a book at around 7, just starting to read. Just like, oh my God, why did we go through all of that? Is that been anything to do with your experience? Have you seen things happen like that? What's your idea of that?
You got to be careful not to go too far the other way, but yeah, it's how you use time and things. So we usually deal, when we're doing, say, English or we're doing other languages, it's always usually a second language. So your first language, you've got to be a bit more careful of and not maybe take so many risks. But for a second language, you can certainly take a lot more risks. And the more you speak before you learn to read, the better the results. So like when I was doing French at school, we'd do 20 hours of, you know, speaking before you'd even do reading and writing. So I mean, when we do our program, we do like 100 hours learning to speak before we do reading. So you do 100 hours learning to speak, you can speak it well, and then you learn reading, and then you do lots of reading input, and then you can do the writing for the output as well. So definitely for languages, that's something that it works like that. Yeah.
Okay. but well.
I've enjoyed every conversation I've had with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. And me too. Thank you very much.
Okay, so glad you're going to put the record off, but I want to have like a little chat with both of you. Is that all right?
Yeah, I'm going to say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.